I'd be happy to respond to questions, or if anybody has anything that they would like to contribute to the discussion, that would also be most welcome. So I don't know if anybody would like to ask or say anything about what I said or what I didn't say. I was talking to somebody in the interval who was saying how he found it very difficult to, well, impossible to bring a sense of kindness or forgiveness towards, say, terrorists, people who harm innocent people. And it was quite interesting to me to notice just how angry he got when he was even thinking about them. And one of the things I suggested for him to contemplate was just his own anger about those people. Because I think when we can actually make contact with that kind of anger within ourselves, it helps us to understand the energy that leads people to commit atrocities. And as I said, it's not always terribly clearly directed. You know, if you're hurting, you know, you just want to hurt anybody back. It's not always terribly refined or subtle. And I don't know if that helped him, but yes.
I think it's also useful to remember how one has to be very sensitive and look very deeply to know if one is not implicit in some atrocities that happen more indirectly. But the atrocities of terrorists are, could be argued, are in retaliation to the atrocities of committed by governments who are seem to be respectable, but there's many decisions and layers of activity which go on which can then be interpreted as resulting in acts which could be described as terrorism or atrocity. And I think that those layers and the support for people, or the not even support for politicians, but the allowing things to happen when you maybe have more of a voice, it kind of brings it down to that. I mean, for me, thinking, well, am I implicit in something which has happened? And I think one has to be very, to look very deeply at
Yeah, that's, I mean, you've hit on something extremely important and significant, which is why I was a little bit wary about going too much into that whole level, the sort of social, political level, because it's very complex. And I think you're absolutely right. And in a way, I think for each of us, in our own lives, have to find, you know, a way of working with our circumstances as best we possibly can, acknowledging that, you know, there may be things that we do that we're part of that actually support something that is not totally wholesome, but at least having the intention to live harmlessly and carefully, and keeping that intention alive, because I think sometimes if that intention is there, you never know when there's going to be an opportunity to do or say something that can have a very good influence. And it's almost as though, you know, our whole life can be like a kind of working towards some moment, maybe it'll be 10 years' time, when you're in a position where you can actually do or say something that will have a real significant influence. And so that's why I tend to kind of make much of something like the precepts, just as a sort of a way of training ourselves, you know, to think in ways that are clear and direct and careful. Yes, it does. It comes down to each one of us. You're absolutely right.
I think that's also, excuse me,
mm-hmm.
when you think because you can do something and feel like it's not worth anything.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, I was watching a documentary about there was a protest in Washington during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a quarter of a million people or something protesting for peace, and then they all went away and the war went on for another 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
They must have felt quite despondent, but then it later came out, declassification of documents and so on, that Nixon had actually made the decision to use a nuclear bomb on Vietnam. And what changed his mind was that the strength of this demonstration, so that kind of changed history. But those people,
at the time, they were.
They maybe felt this.
You never know. You never know. That's the thing. All you can do is to live your own life with as much integrity as you can muster, and then so that you're there if there is a situation. And actually, just just your own sila is something that is there all the time, that people notice it. It's not something that is goes without being noticed, even if it might not be particularly acknowledged by others. It stands out. And thank you. We took part in a walk many years ago when they were having the opening of the Battersea Peace Pagoda in London. A group of about 80 of us walked from Canterbury to London. It was an interfaith walk, and there were large numbers of Christian monks and nuns, and then quite a few of our community, and then the Japanese Nipponzan Myohyoji community, about, 10 of them, monks and nuns. And there was a Baha'i, there's always a Baha'i, and Hindu. Each of the faiths were represented. And we did this walk into London, and it got absolutely no media coverage or anything, I don't think. You know, it could have been, nobody really knew about it. But it was the most, and it looked like nothing much. But for me, it was an incredibly important event, because what it did was just really bring home the sense of our common humanity. You know, when you're walking, many hours a day with people, we all had blisters, we all got tired and cold and hungry, and we didn't sleep, we were sleeping kind of uncomfortably, and just that sense of people of different faiths, different nationalities, just being together as human beings, it sort of cut across any possible differences. It was a very, very, very powerful experience. I think if more people could do, have that kind of experience, you can't see people as other when you've walked together like that and lived together like that in that way. Anything else?
I was thinking about I was referencing the news the other day to elections and what it is the electorate want from the government. And I was thinking, just picking up on your point about politicians, who have been one, and just thinking about that we tend to forget, and picking up on your point, that in fact it is only us, each one of us as an individual, who makes a difference. We can't look to a cabinet or a president or a politburo as an entity, as if somehow they will make the difference for us. It's a bit like it sometimes says that those who believe in the deity. It manifests in those people who do his her work.
Mm.
And I hate it that it's down to me.
It's a really interesting balance to be able to hold that sense lightly enough, you know, so you don't feel completely overburdened with the responsibility of, you know, being, you know, pure and good and responsible. And I'm not quite sure how to do it other than just to really rejoice in your commitment to goodness and the acknowledgement that sometimes you're going to fail. You know, we all make mistakes, and, you know, sometimes we hurt each other. Sometimes we hurt each other and we know that we're hurting somebody. You know, we're hurting and we hurt somebody. And, you know, it's regrettable, but that's what happens. And I think just really rejoicing in our commitment to goodness rather than feeling that we actually have to be good all the time, you know, because that's like putting a kind of constraint, but just having it in your heart. You know, that's what you're committed to, even if it doesn't always manifest the way that you would like. Because life has to be fun as well. I mean, this is one of the things that we can go wrong when we come into monastic life. You know, you can sort of get really very idealistic about it and feel you've got to be perfect monk or nun and absolutely pure and all the rest of it and all these rules that are going to make you so pure and holy. And, you know, you end up, you know, keeping all the rules perfectly, but being totally miserable. You realise that you haven't quite got it. Yes, Margaret?
I quite like being selfish.
Mm-hmm.
It gives me a lot of pleasure, because I feel that one has a right to sometimes be selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can get to put upon terribly.
Mm-hmm. Say a bit more. Yes.
I don't give a damn about doing good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just don't feel like it. But I wouldn't do harm.
Yeah.
But yes. I have to learn to be kind to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It has to begin with you, doesn't it? That's the thing. Yeah. 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 It's nice to hear you say that. Very refreshing. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Well, thank you. But isn't it on a loop that we're back to the me again?
Mm-hmm.
That you said was the basic delusion.
Kind of, but with a.
I'm still indulging the me, whether I love myself or not. I'm still stuck in that groove from ages 1.5, where whenever the me starts to manifest,
You've got a point. And I'm going to have to be very clever to be able to explain, according to my understanding, how it is and it isn't. Because one of the things is we can, like me is a concept, myself, and we can have a very fixed view of me and how it should be and what it should be, and we can have a fixed view of a me that should be terribly unselfish, a me that should never think about itself, that should put everybody else first and not consider oneself. And I realized that that wasn't correct, that that was actually just another me. I was creating an unselfish me instead of a selfish me. And, you know, you can get people who are so humble, you know, competitions to see who can be the most humble. And you realize that that's not it either. And it's to be able to kind of hold this sense of self rather lightly. So you'll notice, like as you practice, you'll begin to notice the sense of self arising. And we had a very sweet example in the chanting yesterday, because I enjoy chanting very much. It's something that I've done for years, and I used to sing in choirs before, and so I sort of think I can do it quite well. And we were in the middle of a chant, and afterwards somebody said to me that they'd noticed I was doing something that wasn't quite right. They said, "Well, I noticed you were sort of, you're extending the vowels rather," or something. It was a minor thing. And I could feel this kind of kind of thing arising that almost made me want to, you know, continue to do it wrong. And it was just that was the sense of self arising. I mean, it hadn't been obvious before then, but at that moment I could actually feel this energy coming. And, you know, you can begin to notice when it arises. If somebody kind of presses your buttons, that's the sense of self. And then you can notice it ceasing as well. You can act on it and then perpetuate it and make it stronger, but you can, just through observing it, through noticing it, you can just see it flaring up, and then you can feel the energy going out of it gradually. You know, because 5 minutes later it didn't bother me at all, and I was doing what they told me, and it all was much better, actually. They were right. So there's a way of studying the sense of self and, you know, being rather clever with it, because, as I said, your sense of self can be just as powerful if it's a kind of humble one, or a self-disparaging one. You know, being a self is not about necessarily thinking you're the best or the most important. It can be about thinking you're the worst and the least important. And actually, not self is about neither of those positions. So when we think of not self in terms of like being part of the common humanity, and realizing that for me to think that everybody else has to be more important than this is actually wrong view, but that this can be included, oh dear, this can be included in all of humanity, and as such, it's just as worthy of my kindness as any other self. I think when I was growing up, I was brought up to be very unselfish and to put other people first. And I was terribly good at doing that. I came into community and I was so unselfish, I was so considerate. But as I said, I was miserable, and I also was quite resentful and quite critical of other people who weren't as unselfish. And I used to get very upset if people didn't notice my needs in the same way I noticed theirs. And I began to realize that actually, I can't expect other people to be mind readers. They're not going to know. You know, I might be very good at anticipating their needs, but I mean, I might imagine wrong. I might get it completely wrong. But I can know about my own needs. I can take responsibility for making sure that they're met, not at the expense of others, but just as part of taking care of humanity, you know, part of a general kindness to all beings. So it's like including this being with the other beings, I think.
Yes, I feel that. I feel that I'm a person too.
Yes.
Be kind to me.
Mm.
I remember years ago somebody said humility can cover a lot of hostility.
Mm-hmm. It can, yes. And pride. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, you see, it's a wonderful position. You know, it's there's a lot of energy there and a very strong sense of self. Yeah. It's dangerous stuff. Righteous indignation is dangerous stuff. And, you know, we can end up doing things at least as bad as what other people do. You know, the ones that we're outraged about, we can be just as brutal with them. And what I'm suggesting is, rather than actually doing it, is just being aware of it when it arises in your own heart. And not out of a sense of blaming yourself, but more just this curiosity. I love the phrase in the chanting that we do. We talk about the Buddha as Lokavidu, the knower of the worlds. I've often talked about this because I find it so inspiring that the Buddha is one who is wise to every level of existence, every possible mind state. So nothing is beneath his concern and interest. So, like within my own heart, if I'm, you know, some of the mind states I have are definitely not things that I would really want to tell anybody about. But, you know, as a disciple of the Buddha, I take an interest in them because that's part of my process of liberation. If I keep them locked away down there, you know, somewhere, you know, round the back, and never bring them out, there's always going to be a certain amount of energy keeping them there. I'm not going to be free, because I'm going to have to sort of put energy into kind of keeping it all together. So I actually want to see these things. You know, I want them to come out into consciousness so I can witness them and see that, like everything else, they arise and cease. And they're not who or what I am, essentially. You know, I'm greater than that. I'm different from that. These are just part of the flow of conditions that, as a human being, I'm subject to. So the more we can allow things into consciousness, the more we can understand of the human predicament, and the more we can free the heart. So, yeah, it's very important. That's one of the things that happens, like when people start meditating sometimes, they get really alarmed because suddenly all of these things start coming into consciousness. You know, as there's a sort of inner relaxation, suddenly, you know, these monsters come out and they kind of come and they say, well, I had no idea what a horrible person I was till I started meditating. I used to think I was placid and, you know, all this rage starts bubbling up. And, you know, it's a huge blessing. It's like a release. And we have the precepts, we have the sila, the commitment to harmlessness, the commitment to kindness, which is like a protection, you know. So even though these things come up, we find some way to diffuse it that is not going to be harmful to ourselves or others. So I remember one winter retreat, Ajahn Sumedho, he said, you know, he pointed to two or three of us and said, well, you should go and scream somewhere. He said, I was one of them. He said, oh, Chandasiri should go away and have a good scream. But I was much too well behaved to do that at that time. I learnt later.
He probably would have said you're too English.
Yes, which would have been even more irritating because I'm not English.
You made reference to conventional truth earlier on.
Yes.
And the way that we tend to kind of function and exist and accept things, concepts and stuff like that. Because that's the convention, that's the reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost very difficult to actually transcend that into moving into, of course, that's the whole idea of the search, the search for enlightenment, the ultimate truth, and how this one kind of meditating and doing the right thing, the right action, actually discern what is conventional truth and what is ultimate truth. And if it's a mammoth task, it's such a difficult task to try and kind of separate and discern.
In one way it is, but in another way, if you realize you're just dealing with one breath at a time, that's all you can do. And so rather than thinking you've got to move the whole mountain, just take a spadeful at a time. So at any moment, just bringing yourself into the body is a way of cutting through. That's like noticing your feet on the ground, noticing the breath. Because when you're breathing, you're not really Linda, you're not really a nurse or whatever. You know, you're just breathing. And so the more that we get used to that as our way of being, rather than identifying with a particular concept, the more that just becomes our natural existence. I mean, I don't think of myself as a nun. I mean, certainly I am a nun, conventionally speaking. There are times when it's, you know, appropriate that I behave like a nun and people address me and treat me like a nun. But most of the time, that's not what's uppermost in my consciousness. You know, I try to, you know, be with the body. I try to be aware of my feet touching the ground, of the breath, of, you know, if I'm feeling tense and I put effort into relaxing. And so to actually keep yourself anchored in a very basic kind of reality, and to see that it's a gradual process of unfolding or cultivation. We talk about cultivation, and so all you have to do is just provide the best possible conditions. So it's like a reconditioning, you know, rather than conditioning into a particular social identity, which is what our education does, is to get back to something much simpler. I mean, you still keep your social identity because that's appropriate. You know, there are times when it's completely appropriate for you to, you know, have a particular role and to fulfill that in particular ways. But ultimately, it's just like a, you know, set of clothes that you put on. Like when I go home to my parents, I'm their daughter. You know, I'm not a Buddhist nun. I mean, except that I, you know, have to eat at certain times and there are certain things I can't do. But, you know, I'm daughter. That's my role there. With my brother, I'm sister. With my sister, I'm sister, and so on. Yeah, you can kind of play games with it as well, and you can write down a whole list of all your labels, all the concepts that you could apply to yourself, and probably be quite a long list. It is tricky though, and it does take time. I used to get really frustrated when people used to sort of talk about not self. And I remember one time, I've told this story often before, about the early days at Chithurst when I was feeling really upset about something. And it was at a time that Ajahn Sumedho was talking a lot about not self, encouraging us to contemplate not self. And I remember walking up the lane with one of the other sisters, and I was kind of complaining about whatever it was and feeling really indignant. And she said, "Oh, well, it's not you anyway." And I could have punched her. Because it definitely was me at that point. You know, the sense of self was very, very strong and it was hurting. And, you know, what she was saying was absolutely true, but her timing was a bit off. So, you know, as I was saying before, you can notice the arising of a sense of self, and you know, the more we can notice that. But you need a sense of humour for this practice. I think it'd be terrible if you weren't able to, you know, laugh in a kind way at yourself when you get stuck on things, because it can be a bit of a workout sometimes. Yeah. I think you're probably right, yeah. I was wondering about undertakers, but I think they probably more than anybody else need a sense of humour. Yes. Yeah, I used to talk to somebody who came to see me quite regularly, and she was a journalist, and she had a terrible time with that, because, you know, obviously she was very much aware of, you know, the level of deprivation that many people have to live with, and her own good fortune, and it was a real burden for her. And it's interesting with guilt. In Buddhist countries, like in Thailand, they don't really have a word for guilt. It's not part of their way of thinking. And we had a elder Thai monk came to visit, and somebody asked him about, you know, guilt and self-hatred, which is obviously so prevalent in this, well, I say obviously, but it seems to be very prevalent in this culture. And they had to explain it to him very carefully, because it wasn't something he'd come across in Thailand. People just don't get involved in that way of thinking. And this way of feeling somehow responsible. I mean, I see, like, in some ways, having a sense of guilt is like, it's like creating a sense of self, that I'm, and that creating a sort of sense of self-responsibility, that it's up to you to make things all right. What I used to say to this woman that I spoke with, you know, was that, well, enjoy what you have, you know, enjoy your privileged circumstances while you have them, because they're not necessarily going to last forever. Things are not going to stay all right forever, so enjoy it while you have it, rather than kind of spoiling it with a sense of over-concern or guilt, which is something, it's something we create as a response to a set of circumstances. It's like an artificial thing that we've added on. It was interesting, many years ago, when we had the family camp here, I talked about the family camp, and on one occasion one of the children died during the camp. They got some kind of mysterious illness that was misdiagnosed, and it turned out to be a kind of virus which proved fatal. And the parents were the ones who got most complicated about it. The children just, we had the child in the Dhamma hall, and they made a very beautiful shrine, and the parents were having a meeting to decide how to tell the children and what to tell the children. Meanwhile, the children had just gone in and were having a look at the little body, completely uncomplicated. The parents had a whole mixture of complicated emotions, and one of them was guilt, because the thought that came up for them was, thank goodness it wasn't my child. And it was very difficult for them just to sort of see it simply as that this child had died, and to empathize with the sorrow that this child's parents were obviously experiencing. So it can be useful just to see, to examine a sense of guilt, you know, which might be to do with, well, thank goodness it's not me, and a kind of fear that maybe, you know, maybe another time it might be you. And rather than seeing it like that, is just to actually enjoy the blessings of your own life, and to, as I said, make a commitment to just living your own life as best you can, in the best possible, making the best possible use of the fortunate circumstances that you have, and learning everything you can from this particular opportunity. And who knows what you've been through in previous lifetimes? I mean, maybe you've had the most ghastly previous lifetimes. You don't know. Maybe it's the result of having done a lot of very good things in your last lifetime that now you're living in more fortunate circumstances. You know, there are many different ways that we can reflect on this. But, you know, if there is a feeling of guilt, then just try to take it apart, try to examine it and see what's going on underneath. It's not... these things are to be... taken apart and understood, rather than struggled with. So, you know, if it's arisen, that's okay, but then take a look at it, see what it's trying to teach you. It may just be that a struggle of the sense of self to survive, like the self is, we have this word Mara in Buddhism. Mara is that which is like the tempter, or that which tries to pull you away from seeing things clearly. And it often presents as like a sense of self, some kind of position. I mean, I've got the, you're a hopeless case, Mara, sense of self. And if I get into the "you're a hopeless case," you know, I can stay there for days until I see it's just Mara, you know, creating. If it can't create a positive, wonderful self, it creates a sort of, you know, some massive problem. And you fix onto it. But the clever person is one who just sort of takes it apart and says, well, hey, what's going on here? What's this about? What does it feel like? Is it necessary? I think in our culture we can make a little bit of a virtue out of guilt. You know, it's almost a way of making yourself feel all right, you know, like a noble, a good quality. But as I said, in traditional Buddhist countries, there's just no such word for guilt. It's not something, and in fact, when this monk was asked and they explained, they said, oh, well, that's just a sort of, udachakakucha, just a sort of restlessness and agitation of the mind. And that was, you know, he just dismissed it like that. You know, not something to pay too much attention to or to make too much of.
Could you tell me, sister, there's an awful lot of crime in Thailand now.
Yes.
Would those criminals feel there's no wrongdoing? Because of their way of thinking?
Well, in Buddhism we have the law of karma. So they would probably recognize that what they were doing was setting themselves up for not such a fortunate rebirth. And they might have some concern about that. So they might go to the monastery and make enormous amounts of offerings in an effort to counterbalance the unwholesome activity. So it's seen more in that way. Like the whole thing is held in a much broader context. So the law of karma, like if you act or speak in ways that are unwholesome, there will be a result. If you act or speak in ways that are wholesome, then there will be another result. And so we don't have to figure that out, either for ourselves or for anybody else, but rather to put effort into cultivating good, just because it's the thing that makes sense, actually, you know, when you... because as you practice, it becomes much more immediate. Like, you know, if you do something mean, there's a sense of regret. You know, you'd rather not have done that. Whereas if you do something good, then there's a kind of a nice feeling, and it's okay to feel that. You know, sometimes we feel guilty about feeling good, but you know, we're allowed to experience that pleasant feeling in the heart from having, you know, lived carefully, done something considerate and kind to another person, or even just not having done something beastly when we felt like doing something mean. Having practiced restraint, we can feel pleased about that. Anything else? Yes.
Going back to the peace thing, I heard the monk in Thailand say that this meditation brings about peace in the world.
Yeah. Sometimes that's the best we can do. And there are many monks and nuns, both within this tradition, other traditions, whose whole life is a life of meditation. They never talk to anybody, their whole life is working at the level of the heart. And that's a really lovely thing to contemplate, in fact. Others of us are called to be more active, you know, it's our place is to do something that is more, involves speech and action in the world. It's different for different people. But certainly meditation I would definitely encourage for everybody to take time each day just to sit quietly and just listen. Just notice how things are for you. If you'd like to meditate formally, then do that. But if it's not something you're accustomed to doing, just to take 5 minutes just to sit and just notice how it is for you and the kind of voices going on. Whether it's fear or irritation or anger or guilt or regret, whatever it might be, just to sort of pay gentle attention, as though you were listening to somebody else, with an attitude of kindness and curiosity, and just to keep coming to the breath, coming to the body, as a way of just anchoring the awareness. It can be a very, very helpful way of just refreshing the whole being.
And can we achieve that in a level of consciousness through meditation?
Yeah. You can, for some people, it's individual, very individual. Yeah, for some people, it can happen very, very quickly. For other people, it takes longer. The important thing is to just cultivate this sense of curiosity and presence, so that, you know, throughout the day, you can notice what's going on. You know, you have things to do, you have conversations to have, and just try to notice what happens in between those times. And how you think about yourself and how you think about other people. Just little things like that can be very insightful, very useful as a kind of exercise. And you'll probably notice, like for many people, what they notice is a lot of self-criticism. We do tend to be quite harsh and critical of ourselves. And so to begin to try to see oneself in a more kind way and can be a useful first step, just cultivating kindness towards this being here. And then gradually that extends towards others, quite naturally. Yeah. But meditation is something you need to work at a bit. So we have meditation workshops here. You can come and receive instruction and practice together with other people. And then coming on retreat is a very good way to deepen the practice and really begin to see more how it actually works with the teachings and so on. And then coming to spend time in the monastery, and then we'll shave your head and you can be... I'm joking. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think that there's a differentiation between like concentration practice. Like for some people, when they meditate, the mind can become very concentrated and experience a terrific feeling of ease and happiness and relaxation. Because, you know, supported by the conditions of meditation. So you're in a quiet place, you're sitting still, your eyes closed perhaps, or focusing on something calming. And then understandably, when you're receiving more sense data, the mind is going to be affected by that. And so to make a distinction between concentration and awareness, or mindfulness. So in your meditation, it sounds to me as though you probably become quite concentrated, which is great. I mean, that's a lovely thing to be able to cultivate. But to focus also on the whole quality of mindfulness, so which is like a more general day-by-day, moment-by-moment awareness. So you can be aware when you're meditating of the fact that, okay, the mind is quite settled now. And then you can notice that as you change posture, as you begin to move around, that the mind becomes more active. And you can still keep an awareness of the body. Obviously, it won't be so focused. But to see that meditation, like this, we call it vipassana, samatha vipassana. Samatha is like the concentration aspect, the collectedness. Vipassana is more insight, or more just of general all-round mindfulness. And it's that we're cultivating in daily life. We can't stay concentrated in daily life. You can't maintain that level of focus other than, you know, for brief moments, or if you're doing a particular activity that demands that, you know, like if you're really, I don't know, working at something that demands a terrific amount of focus. But you can maintain a more fluid kind of mindfulness. So I use the body a lot myself as a kind of anchor in everyday life. You know, when you're walking from one place to the other, the feet touching the ground, Like during this talk, I was noticing sometimes I was getting tense, and so I was, you know, putting attention into relaxing the face, the shoulders, the hands. And so to see meditation as being something broader than the very focused state that you can get into in meditation, that some people can get into, I should say, because for other people that the meditation is less relaxed and pleasant. Yes, and often the more relaxed and pleasant it's been in meditation, the more difficult it is emerging. I mean, my concentration tends to be not so good, but the times that I have been really focused in my meditation are the times I have to be most careful about the transition, because I can feel very irritable and resentful if I have to talk to somebody having been so calm and blissful. And you know, so it's, as you say, you suddenly find, I mean, you realize the limitations of concentration actually through that. You know, concentration is fine, and it's what the Buddha referred to it as an allowable pleasure. You know, it's something that is very, very pleasant, and there's nothing harmful in it. But you do have to take care about the transition to a more active mode of being, because there can be these sort of, you know, feelings of irritation and so on. It's not necessarily transformative, other than realizing that it's an alternative pleasure to the kind of pleasures that many people seek gratification through, you know, like delicious food or sex or whatever. When you find that pleasure in meditation, you realize, well, actually this is free, and it doesn't cause any harm to anybody, and you know, as I said, it's an allowable pleasure. So there can be that insight, but it's also impermanent, and it has there's an inherent kind of unsatisfactoriness. So it needs to be backed up with insight. You have to have it balanced with understanding, and then it's a very it provides a very good basis for that. So, yeah. Yes.
When one is totally absorbed doing something one loves, so that everything else is excluded, maybe for hours, would that have the same benefits, do you think, as meditation, or is it a similar thing?
I think so. I mean, I notice myself sometimes. You know, if I've been very, very busy doing a lot of things, it's difficult to sit in meditation. You know, sometimes to go out and do some pottering about in the garden is helpful as a kind of intermediary, just to sort of help the mind to settle and to get absorbed into something. Also because I think we tend to be rather critical, and if the mind doesn't settle in meditation, we can feel that we've failed and we're not doing it right. So to find something that you do enjoy, obviously that's not going to cause harm to other beings, as a way of just gathering the mind and settling the mind, you know, can be very, very skillful. So there are certain craft activities that can, you know, absorb the mind in that way. I wouldn't see it I wouldn't see it necessarily as a substitute for meditation, because it can become a bit of an obsession. You know, you can find that you get absorbed into it, but then it can be difficult to sort of set it aside. You know, you just keep wanting to do it, and need to guard against that a little bit. But I'm quite interested in kind of more active kinds of meditation, and even just washing up can be very calming and settling for the mind. And sometimes, you know, when our lives are very hectic, very demanding, things like that can be really supportive, rather than necessarily, you know, sitting cross-legged and feeling you've got to get into some kind of, you know, terrific concentrated state. It can be very, very nice, gentle transition. You know, as long as one's doing it, you know, from a place of mindfulness, so you're actually in touch with what's happening right now. You're with the body. You're noticing what's going on in the mind. Rather than the mind just sort of going on and on and on, a stream of thought that may not be particularly helpful, you know, sort of full of a grudge or vindictiveness of some kind, blaming oneself, blaming others. That's not such a useful train of thought. So for mindfulness, we have the four foundations of the body, feeling, the mind itself, the state of mind itself, and the kind of thoughts that are going on in there. So we're aware of each of those things. Each of those are kind of reference points. So I don't know if that answers the question.
When I do photography, I'm completely in another world for several hours just with what I'm doing.
I mean, really the test with these things is, well, what's it like when you come out of it? What's it like in the rest of your life? What's it like in terms of your state of ease and well-being and liberation? You know, if you're becoming completely obsessed with it or conceited about it or resentful or frustrated if somebody comes along and interrupts you, then, you know, there are some questions one would want to ask. And then, not to say that it's wrong, but you might want to just adjust the way that you do it. So it's always like looking at the result, you know, and for each one of us, you know, there are these different techniques of meditation that we learn when we go on retreat, and for each one of us, you know, we invent our own practice. You know, you have the teachings, you have the guidance, the techniques, but for each of us, we figure out how to work it in our own life. And, you know, some things work wonderfully well for one person, but a complete disaster for another. Or they might be really wonderful for oneself at one time, but not so good at another time. Yes?
I just want to ask about strong opinions and sort of strong beliefs, because I think that with my own experience, having sort of held quite sort of strong opinions about certain things, which obviously thought were right, you know, it caused a lot of problems, you know, it kind of acted as a barrier to sort of relating yourself to the rest of the world, and very easy to start blaming people. Mm. You can start to blame yourself about things if you hold very strong opinions. And I think someone once said that, you know, the antidote to opinion is curiosity. I'm just a bit curious and view things, but what do you think about this? What your opinion?
My opinion is.
I live in a world without really holding strong opinions. Do you think it's possible? And you think it's okay to hold opinions, but just to be aware of them?
It's important to be aware of them, to notice, and particularly to notice what happens when they're challenged. Because that's where we can really get ourselves into trouble. There's a lovely phrase in the Buddha's words on loving kindness, a chant that we do quite frequently at the end. It says, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So he doesn't say it's not having fixed views, but not holding to them. So Ajahn Chah always used to talk about not certain, not sure, which I think is the same thing as you mean about curiosity. So acknowledging that there may be another way of looking at something. If we hold tight to something, there's a kind of contraction around it. Like if you have a view about something and I come along and challenge you, the test is to see, well, can you still hold on to it, still honour your own position without clenching up around it and using it as a way of separating yourself? And this is a very difficult thing to do, but it's a very worthwhile, it's fun. I mean, it gets to be fun after a while. I mean, you may find a kind of tensing up first of all when I say something that is different from what you feel. But to see if you can just notice that tensing up and then just relaxing. It doesn't mean that you have to throw away your own view, you know, because it might be a very good view. It might be perfectly correct, and I might be totally wrong, completely off. It's like keeping the channel of communication open, you know. So keeping in mind our common humanity, that's like the bottom line, really, our common humanity. And okay, you see it that way, but I see it this way. It may be that there's something that I'm sort of expressing that is, you know, you can see is totally wrong and actually causing me a lot of unnecessary suffering. If you can avoid clenching up and getting into a position, there's a possibility that you can talk to me about it, you know, that you can help me come to another view about, you know, whatever it is that I've expressed so strongly. I find it interesting sometimes when I meet like born-again Christians. When I was in India, several times I met very committed Christians, and they were quite interested in converting me, which I always felt was a bit of a cheek, actually. But, so I used to kind of work at this sort of relaxing thing, and actually just sharing in their joy. You know, so there was one group who came, and they each told me their story and how they'd met Jesus. And I actually have a Christian upbringing, so I know quite a lot of the Bible. So I was able to kind of quote bits of the Bible and share in their gladness. And they were completely, they didn't really have much of a space to stand on, because they had a position as Christians, and that I was a Buddhist, and that they wanted to kind of convert me. Whereas sort of meeting them as another human being took away the ground, but it opened up something, you know, much, much more beautiful, really, where I wasn't being sort of pulled into something against my wishes. Neither was I resisting. I was, like, sort of bringing it to a different level. There was another one who tried to convert me, and, you know, we got talking, and he was very interested in learning about meditation. Because it turned out that his life wasn't so wonderful. You know, he was holding on to his view, hoping it was going to make things all right. And, you know, it just took a few minutes to realize that actually his life was a mess. You know, he had a lot of problems. And, you know, that there were things that, you know, I could say that would be helpful without converting him or, you know, making him into a Buddhist, but just, you know, broadening his view. So, to be able to kind of keep a channel of communication open can be very helpful. Sometimes it's not possible. You know, some people are so fixed that it's not possible. And, you know, then that's all right too. You know, you can still keep your heart open. But if they want to stay over there, that's their business. It's their choice rather than something that you've done to them. It's like having. It's okay to have an opinion, to have a view, to have a position, but as you say, to know it, and to hold it in a way that is kind of light and respectful. You know, if you have, we can be too ready to kind of surrender our view of, you know, what we feel is important, and it's okay to feel that certain things are important. And, you know, to live your life according to certain principles. I mean, that's what we're all doing, really. Yeah. I wonder if it's time to let those of you who need to go, and if anybody would like to stay, you're welcome to stay. I'll be here for another little while. I wish you all well. Oh, another question at the back there.
This is the first time I came here, and I think that we need to speak. But since I'm high, so I felt like I was referred to some part of English. So I think I maybe would like to qualify some English parts, such as the word beauty. Actually, when I was young, I learned this word. But we don't say beauty. We say something like feeling good, feeling bad, not feeling bad and beauty. So the word beauty is more like medical terminology, which is not used in general.
Mm-hmm. I'm very glad you brought that point, because it's to feel regret is fine. If you do something unwholesome, then there's going to be a feeling of regret. And so the important thing is that we use that, we learn from that, and we use that as an encouragement not to repeat the same mistake. So it's a very useful thing, like hiriyotapa. Whereas guilt is when you hold on to it and you go over it, over it, over it. And I think that's the difference. So certainly to feel regret is important. You know, if you do something that's regrettable, then to feel the regret, but to use that as an encouragement to be more careful next time. Yes, thank you.
I suppose regret really is about something that's actually happened. Guilt is yes. A feeling that is free-floating.
That's a good way to look at it, yes. So regret is actually something quite specific that, yes, I regret that. I mean, one can regret things that are not to do with oneself at all. You know, I regret that whatever it is happened, even though it's not your fault, but... certainly when it is your fault, or you have done something that maybe was hurtful or harmful to others, it's actually important to feel it. It's a very important part of the process. It's something we can really grow through and learn from. So yeah, very good point.
I just have an experience which may be helpful for people to hear about. It's one... which gave rise to extreme remorse and indeed guilt feeling for some time. It was when we went to India and Ayavachana died. She died various things, stroke, deep brought on, I thought, by dehydration.
You were on the pilgrimage with her?
I was with her.
Ah, right.
And I felt at the time and did try to persuade her that rehydration was the only solution, that she had very firm, fixed beliefs in forms of medicine which I didn't have fixed beliefs in, so my medicine was foreign to her, and just as hers was foreign to mine. And she died. She died on, she went back to Delhi and went to a doctor, a practitioner whom she trusted, and he was unable to do anything. Yet there was a hospital not far away which would have rehydrated her. And I felt such remorse, and in fact guilt, for months afterwards. I spoke to Ajahn Sucitto, and he's very wise, and he summed up, he decided, I'm sure he thought carefully for a few moments and decided what course of action to take. It. And he was quite severe with me, as he can be, very severe. He said, that's remorse. He said, you no need to feel remorse, that's arrogance. And if he'd been a Zen monk, he would have hit me with his stick. It would have had the same effect. I thought, yeah. Wow. And not instantly, but from then on, it dropped away.
Yeah.
Yes, that's arrogance. Let it go. You did what you could. You tried.
Yeah. She was a very headstrong lady.
Yeah.
I remember a story that Ajahn Sucitto, I was telling him a remarkable experience I'd had of insight and warmth and love. And I asked him, I said, can you tell me what that was? And he said, that's what's known as normality.
It's interesting, though, how something like that can get a hold of you, isn't it? That feeling of regret or remorse or guilt.
I couldn't let it go for some time.
Yeah. Sort of feeling responsible. And not really acknowledging that you did the very best you could.
You know,
and
why didn't I? I'm jobbing backwards, as they say.
Yes, yes.
But I could have, I should have.
Yes, yes. Yeah. You can see wonderfully what to do with hindsight, can't you?
Yeah.
How it should have gone, but it went the way it did, and you did what you did, which for you was the best you possibly could do at that time. And that's what happened.
This lady did what she wanted to do.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I think she decided that was her karma. That was what was going to happen.
Mm. Yeah, she'd done what she needed to do in her life.
A more cheerful story, which was told to me in quite a different context, a very banal context, many people would have thought. And this was a story about a man walking along the beach at ebb tide springs. And at that time, of course, there are many starfish remain on the sand, and when the sun comes out, they'll dry up and die. Mm. He was walking along the beach in the morning, and throwing these starfish out back into the sea.
Mm.
And another man saw it, said, "What on earth are you doing that for?" He said, "The population won't be affected by what you're doing.
Mm.
The starfish population is self-regulating, it's just a normal thing." He kept on, he picked up another starfish and threw it out to the sea, and he said, "Well, it sure made a difference to that one." And really, it wasn't that the starfish it was having an effect on. It was on the man who was doing it. Mm. He was doing that.
Mm.
And it's the same as one's personal meditation.
Mm.
All we can do is just do this little bit.
And actually just trust that other people are doing something similar.
When you say the spider, it's because
and to you.
You have glycidus up here.
Have what?
Glycidus.
You'll have to say what that is.
And it's the most beautiful little thing, like a miniature squirrel.
Oh, right.
But they're very destructive, like squirrels. And they go into everybody's roof.
Oh.
And they go up the walls. And they are protected by law.
Oh.
I've got some friends who live, I don't get them, fortunately, but I've got some friends who live opposite, and they catch them.
Mm.
And I make them take them up to the roof. They're very grateful if a cat catches them instead. But they've really become quite a pest. They've spread and spread, and they've gone as far as Amersham and Luton, I read.
Mm.
They're so pretty.
I suppose there are no natural predators, or the cats.
Cats,
would,
yes. But they seem to do very well.
Maybe that's enough.
Thank you.
Thank you.